This is part two of the interview with Mr. Jeff Blankford discussing Israel's special relationship. But it'll ruin you. You can never go above a certain mark in journalism if you are willing to call a spade on the Israeli-Palestinian issue.
We've seen that happen.
Yep.
And there's no other subject. You can make all kinds of outrageous statements about American slavery and how benevolent most slave masters were to the slaves. You can make comments or ignore the genocide of Native Americans or argue that it wasn't genocide at all. And, I mean, this is something that came up during the question period after my talk, in which I talked about, you know, I mentioned that there was no museum in Berlin that commemorated or commemorated the genocide of Native Americans in the United States, nor of 400 years of slavery. People will say, well, why would there be one in Berlin? And then you say, well, why is there a Holocaust museum in the United States? When I was in Washington, I went to see the Museum of Native Americans, the American Indian Museum. I'm not sure the name of it. Well, and it's an amazing
place. And the last spot possible, too.
Yeah, and it's interesting. It's a beautiful museum, and it discusses what's happened to indigenous populations going down to the tip of South America. Nowhere does it say what happened and who did it. Now, it may be there somewhere hidden, but I didn't see it. I didn't spend hours there, but I went on every floor. I looked around. I didn't see anything that showed who was guilty of the genocide. And yet,
that starts with the Caribbean with 11 million killed during Columbus's stint, and he's got his own holiday named after him. But, yeah, the Caribbean's he brushed under even more than North and South America. It's just, oh, well, there are no Caribs anymore, and there aren't natives in the Caribbean anymore. They're, Africans and British and whatever else, but not American Indian. But there was 11 million killed in the first 2 years, and then you see all the disease. I mean, there was, basically, 20% of the entire population of Earth was wiped out. By far the largest genocide in history. And they get one room in a museum and they won't tell you who did it. And it is denied as much as possible.
I remember in the commentary magazine, a Jewish historian, Gabriel Schoenfeld, arguing why the genocide against Native Americans, well, that should not be called genocide. You know, actually, the word genocide did not exist until World War II. Whole peoples have been slaughtered over the centuries, but it wasn't until they needed a new word, even though the number of, for example, Congolese, over 10 million were killed in the later part of the 19th century.
Or under
the Belgians. Or the Ukrainians, the same numbers in the 30s from famine. Just interesting that word had to be created. Just like capital H Holocaust, a special word, special words to define and a special narrative. And people were upset with me. Some people were upset when I said back in Washington that the official narrative has to be accepted. You can't question that narrative. And then, what's his name, Justin Raimondo of antiwar.com, who exposes tribalism by blurting out that the Holocaust should be taught. There was no question. I was saying that American students get, in the eighth grade, at least in California, get an overdose of Anne Frank. And then when they go into ninth grade, they get Eli Wiesel. Yeah, and this is in English. Well, I'm not even talking about history. This is English reading. So there are so many other books that students can be reading for English that are not propaganda or used for propaganda.
That's what English class.
But yet, I'm sorry?
I used to always call English class propaganda class. All your books are like that.
No, there are some other good books, but the teachers have to choose them, whereas Anne Frank and Elie Wiesel are mandated. These are books, and you don't just read the book. You get television interview. I mean, you get videos of people who knew Anne Frank, knew Anne Frank family, have nothing to do with English literature. When it comes to the, this is nothing against Anne Frank or the fact that some things appear to be in ballpoint afterward, but there's no question how Anne Frank's story has been used. Like the book Exodus was written by Leon Uris because he was sent over to Israel to write a propaganda book for Israel. And this should be more well known than it is, but it's amazing how these books get used for propaganda. Whatever the source, they get used for propaganda. And Elie Wiesel's Night, you get in the ninth grade, and then you go through all the lesson plans that provide information about the Holocaust and so on. And then when you get to history, you open the book. The same students will read that in 1948, during the war, the Palestinians migrated from Palestine. Migrated. Amazing word, isn't it? Mm-hmm. But this is how
blurted out. They should hear it the way they hear it.
I'm sorry?
What did Justin Raimondo blurt out?
Well, he blurted out that he got very upset when I criticized the amount of Holocaust education that students were getting. That he thought that they should get a lot of it. And Phil Weiss of Mondo Weiss said the same thing. Some woman had raised the issue from the audience about Zionist-Nazi collaboration and teaching in the schools, and I had mentioned the Zionist-Nazi collaboration in my introduction, because when I told the audience that I had been asked to speak about the gatekeepers on the left, I began with quoting, I said, Lenny Brenner, who I had learned a lot from, by the way, about the lobby. He was the one who taught me about particularly the role of the Democrats being a subsidiary of the Israel lobby. And I mentioned that he was the expert, had written about the Zionist-Nazi connection, which I mentioned. I looked at one of my fellow panelists, Phil Weiss. I said, which is a taboo subject for Phil, who had otherwise an interesting blog called Mondo Weiss, but he banned me from commenting on it when I posted comments about the Zionist-Nazi collaboration in the 30s in Germany.
I think it's safer to say the Zionist collaboration with Russian oligarchs in the 90s and now. But World War II is sort of what is used to justify every war after it. It's the good war. And so it's the most taboo thing ever, even though the Allies killed millions of people themselves. And don't forget that they were all colonial powers, that India was part of Britain, for example, and France ran
most
of Africa. Like, that's just considered, well, that's okay, because they did it a long time ago or something, that was all right. But they murdered all these millions of people. And, of course, the Russians murdered millions of people, and so did the Chinese. But only the Holocaust is the bad stuff. All the millions that the Allies killed, the millions of Germans they killed after the war, too, and Eisenhower's death camps, and all the starvation, which was intentional. And although that doesn't matter. Because if you talk about that, it makes it bad versus bad, rather than, you know, white hat versus black hat. And they need that to be the good war. Because you see, in every war afterward, they create a new Hitler. You know, the epitome of evil. And we have to go stop the evil monster Hitler. Whereas,
that's right,
Hitler was an evil monster, but so are the leaders of the Allied power. So was Stalin. So was Churchill. I mean, they killed 3 or 4 million people in Bengal during the same war. Half a million Greeks. And these are places that were under British rule or French rule. And after the war, of course, they starved all those people. And they had internment camps in Canada and the United States for the Japanese. And, of course, there was the nuking of Nagasaki and Hiroshima and so on. And they underplay the numbers there. You think that you wipe out an entire city and it's only 100,000 people. I really question those numbers, and they've inflated some of the numbers on the other side, but to bring that up is just sacrosanct blasphemy. I mean, you cannot question any aspect of the Holocaust, too. And it, to me, the article, the, is disturbing because there have been many genocides. And that's what the Holocaust is. It's a genocide. It's not different from other genocides where people were targeted for their ethnic or religious views, or lack of religious views, and killed. But what it is that America didn't do it for once. So someone else did it, and that's why that one's very evil and all the other ones are okay, because the Allies are responsible for the other 95% of genocides.
Well, this is when Phil Weiss said that the West owed the Jews after the war, and now we owe the Palestinians, but that didn't come across in the same way. But why did the West owe the Jews and not the Congolese? You know, we gave, you know, it's this kind of thinking, and certainly even as far as Japan goes, the firebombing of Tokyo. This was a terrible crime, which considered a great victory in the United States. I mean, the distortions of history, every country does this, but the United States is the superpower, and we're able to be so hypocritical, particularly Ukraine. Is a joke. I mean, but even then, going
the
back,
thing, some of them, the right wingers over here, are trying to downplay the Nanking massacre, and they say conquer women for, you know, forced sex slavery during the war. There are always some nuts like that. But to scale, it is the U.S. But the thing is, you can criticize that, and you won't be met with the kind of flack you will if you question aspects of World War II on the Allies' side.
But the difference is that no other country has bases in 130 countries, 700, more than 700 bases in 130 countries. So when the United States does something or says something, the hypocrisy is even greater. I mean,
don't have laws preventing people from talking about them.
Right.
We need a law to prevent people from talking about something. There's something to hide. Or that's how it seems. You say, well, if that's the case, then that makes you want to question it more, you would think, if it has to be protected like that, enshrined by law, not to talk about these figures or whatever. But, yeah, I mean, it's worrisome. It's scary to talk about the Holocaust. It's scary to talk to people who question any aspect of it. And I'm not talking about people who deny it outright. Like, there was no Holocaust. I'm not talking about that stuff.
Yeah, you're right. Saying, like, I know what
well,
you mean.
Well, maybe it wasn't this many people, or maybe there... these things that we know now, soap and lampshades or whatever, was post-war propaganda, which is a fact. But there are still some lingering, you know, folks that think, no, that the human hair mattresses and all the horror stories, I mean, it's like the babies in incubators for the first Iraq war. Like,
They still believe that. The lampshades and soap,
There weren't any babies on incubators. You can point out the lies for other wars. You can point out the Niger forgeries for the second Iraq war, or how they were not making anthrax, and there wasn't a meeting in Prague, and they didn't have anything to do with 9/11, and all these other wars. And you can, in past wars, the Spanish-American War, the Mexican-American War, the Civil War, you can point out lies that have been told, but not World War II. Never.
Well, actually, they didn't eventually deny. There was no evidence ever found that human skin was made into lampshades, nor into soap.
Oh, no, I mean, that was admitted now. I mean, that was a Billy Wilder prop. You know, they actually had people, Hollywood moguls, come over and stage that whole thing for the city of Weimar and Buchenwald. They came and had a display. I mean, just something totally horrific to denazify the Nazis. And they needed that kind of extreme, weird stuff about, you know, like pelvis bones used as ashtrays and soap and lampshades and stuff, because there was nothing worse than what actually had happened that the Allies were not also guilty of. You killed lots of people, okay? You shot lots of people. You starved people. Well, the Allies did all that too. You had to find something more horrible than that, and you had to get pretty creative to do it in order to make the Nazis more evil. And so that's why they had the theatrics of the the mattresses and the shrunken heads and the lampshades and all that. But now it's admitted it came right out of the OSS's psych war department. When C.D. Jackson was in charge of it, he went on to run Time Life, and it was complete psychological warfare. And that's admitted in history now, but you don't have these arguments with historians. You have these arguments with people who are not historians, who just sort of heard something right in middle school or whatever and stuck with it and never got corrected.
Yeah, it's impossible to have a reasonable discussion or challenge any part of the narrative. For example, very few people know that in March of 1933, American Jews were going to hold, or did hold, a huge rally in Madison Square Garden, and it was going to call for a worldwide boycott of the Nazis. And this is just after Hitler became elected. And the Jewish organizations in Germany beseeched American Jews not to have this rally. And two American Jewish organizations, the American Jewish Committee, which today is like the State Department for the lobby, and B'nai B'rith, which was the oldest and largest Jewish organization at the time, they were founded by German Jewish immigrants. They opposed having this rally in Madison Square Garden because it was clear that people would suffer from the result of it would be the German Jews. And so they held this rally in March of 1933. And the very next day after the rally, papers all across the world had the headline in different languages, "Jews Declare War Against Germany." And the American Jewish Journal of American Jewish History, which was not Zionist, I have a copy of it somewhere, has a long article about this with pictures of the headlines in the newspapers. So here's a message to the Germans who were unfairly punished after World War I, that international Jews are declaring war on Germany, an economic boycott on top of what happened at Versailles. It certainly played into the hands of the Zionists, who then broke the boycott.
Hitler's propaganda.
It helped with Hitler's propaganda.
And then here they have headlines like that. That probably didn't help their...
Exactly. But that's the thing. Has nothing to do itself with the Holocaust itself. Numbers or gas chambers or whatever. But it does have to do with the narrative. And you can't talk about it.
Well, the 6 million number had been said all during World War I. And it was said all through World War II before it ended. That number had already been decided because it fulfills a religious prophecy. It had nothing to do with the facts on the ground, but it's illegal to say that in some countries. But it doesn't matter.
Actually,
you're splitting hairs if you're going to be like it was 5 million or 6 million or whatever. It's atrocious anyway. Like, I'm not interested in the exact number. Like, that's to me is like a not really relevant, you know. But I do think it's wrong that, you know, just for historical accuracy, for people who just are concerned with truth, like, they ought to be allowed to say whatever they find. You shouldn't censor anything.
Well, I actually, in the beginning after the war, as I remember, they said 4 to 6 million, and suddenly they dropped the 4 and it became 6 million. There are 3 million names approximately in Yad Vashem in Jerusalem. And probably that's closer to the truth. It's a horrible, 1 million would have been a horrible figure. 500,000 Roma, gypsies, were murdered. They're forgotten totally. A huge proportion of the gypsy population, Roma population. The point is, it was a horrible crime, but not to be able to discuss the whole history of what happened in any kind of historical context, as you discuss every other historical event, there's something wrong with that. And I believe, as you suggested, this is one of the reasons that people begin to question it, especially when you see the Zionists lying and lying and lying about everything else. I mean, I know people who believe it didn't happen simply because they see what Israel does and what its spokespeople say.
They throw the baby out with the bathwater. Like, well, they lied about this,
right?
And maybe it's all untrue. Another figure I just want to bring up because it's sort of a pet peeve of mine. They talk about the American Civil War and they say there were 700 thousand people killed, but they're omitting that that's actually only those on the north that died. That's the Americans that died, and the South lost another 600 too. So Altogether, you have well over a million there, too. But they only count half the numbers on that war. But they don't that the North lost 100,000 more people than the South, I guess. I don't know what the reason is for that, but why wouldn't you include the Southern deaths? That's disturbing.
Well, it's interesting. I don't know if they have all the statistics. Interesting, American Jews fought on both sides in that war. And I have a book here which lists all the names because the Jews in the South supported slavery. Some were slaveholders. And, of course, the treasurer of the Confederacy was Judah Benjamin. So you had it's interesting that here's a people who suffered under slavery, but when it came to being involved in slavery and profiting from it in the South and in the North, because we had slavery in the North as well for a long time, they had no problem. So, but this is also something that's never discussed. So
they enslaved the Chinese post-war to finish the railroads and then slaughtered the Indians. So racism was pretty pervasive throughout
the country.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. But most Americans don't grow up, do not knowing that slavery existed all over the United States.
It was all over the North. And there were some states that forbid blacks from even entering the state as part of Indiana's state constitution. They wouldn't allow them. But what made people switch had nothing to do with morals or sympathy for Africans. It was just that wage slavery was actually more cost efficient than cattle slavery. If you had to buy a slave, it could cost as much as a house, but you could get Irish immigrants or Polish immigrants and pay them and make them use the money they got right back to the company store and the landowners,
right,
slumlords. And they were slaves anyway, because a slave, you give them a free house and free food. A wage slave, it's not free, but it is, because they have to return their wages right back to you, and they're more replaceable, and you don't have to purchase them outright. So wage slavery was actually more cost-efficient, and it's still... It's not as bad as cattle slavery, because a wage slave can at least, you know, have some rights, choose who they want to marry, they can move and have some other master or whatever. It's a little bit better for them. But it's really because it was better for the owners that it switched. It had nothing to do with benevolence towards Africans or anything. Everybody was racist and continued to be racist for over 100 years. They were still segregated, and there were race riots in New York and hanging blacks and this and that. I mean, the story post-Civil War, they have to give it some do-gooder face to make it seem like, you know, the good guys won or whatever, but that's not what happened. I mean, mostly it was over taxes and other things, and slavery wasn't even brought up until 2 years into the war, where Lincoln had supported the Back to Africa movement. When he was a congressman, he was outright racist, but they needed to keep the British and French out of the war from aiding the South, and so they had recently emancipated their own, so that was the reason for that. But I mean, Civil War is a complex topic, but again, each war, what we hear, the way we hear about the Civil War being about slavery would be like years and years from now hearing that the Iraq War is about liberating the Kurds or something, because that propaganda
right
is out there, and it is in newspapers if you wanted to find it, but that is definitely not why we went to war in Iraq.
It's interesting that the Emancipation Proclamation was issued, as I say, not to free the slaves, but to assure the British working class that this was a war against slavery, because Britain was about to come into the war on the side of the South, and there were mass meetings being held in England. And so they took the Emancipation Proclamation over to England as fast as they could get it on a ship to block the British from coming in on the side of the South. If the British had come in on the side of the South would have probably won. So, but this part, this
up to that point anyway, and it's when they lost supplies from Europe because they didn't have the manufacturing the North did.
Yeah, they started right. Slowly lose the war. I mean, but
the best generals and things, and the North had a lot of their system was screwed up because they had conscripts and they had a lot of nepotism as to who got higher ranks or whatever. It wasn't really based on ability. And they thought it'd be okay because they had like five times the population and all the manufacturing. And they thought it'd be an easy war. And you know, generalship matters, they found out.
Well, the South had good generals. But interesting, one of the things you find in the American history textbook is that John Brown was a fanatic. and that here is one of the real American, let's say, revolutionaries who fought to free the slaves and helped to keep them out of Kansas, slavery out of Kansas. And yet, you know, the history books make him into a nutcase, which is quite interesting, even though when Union soldiers marched to war, marched into the South, they sang his name. John Brown's body lies a moldering in his grave, but his soul goes marching on. And from that song became a song that every student learned called the Battle Hymn of the Republic. But it was based on the song about John Brown. And American students go to school and they never learn that. They see a picture of John Brown with his hair flying out as if he's some kind of fanatical nutcase. One history book the kids have today blames John Brown as one of the causes. His attack at Harper's Ferry was one of the causes of the Civil War. I mean, these are the same kids who are reading Anne Frank and Eli Wiesel. So they come out of school having no idea or kind of a twisted idea. Or
all the literature you could read about World War II if you wanted to make the case of how horrible it was for the non-Aryans in Germany. Why Anne Frank? Why would you pick the one that's just dripping with fraud and conflict? Like, you could get so many other actual books that really happen without conflict, and yet they get this one, which the majority of it wasn't written by the girl they say it was written by, and couldn't have been. And that all came out in the trial that was supposed to verify it, ended up doing the opposite. But again, and I was shocked to hear that. I had no reason to doubt it. You know, I read that in school and everything, but it was very shocking to find that out. And it makes me question everything else I was told to read in school.
Well, there are so many other books that could be read. The idea that it's mandated, that the teacher doesn't have a choice. And of course, what they do is provide the Anti-Defamation League, Jewish organizations provide wonderful teaching aids that enable, that helps the teacher teach his or her course. And so this is makes the job easy for the teacher, and it distorts the whole history of World War II, which most students come away believing Hitler declared war on the Jews, and that was largely what the war was all about. It's interesting, speaking of Hitler.
And passing over World War I.
World War One. They cover it.
Them, they're like, why did that happen? They forget. It's passed over in school as almost in a hurry to get to World War II. Because the Allies started World War One, and you have to understand that how the German lands have been taken from German-speaking people, and how that was more of a why people supported Hitler and the economic turnaround that he had in the beginning. That was their support. It wasn't rallied around hating people at first. It was around trying to regain lands that used to be German anyway.
I mean, well, that was World War II.
In any other country. But
it's
hard to say that.
Yeah.
You know, it's how it turned out later. But it's not as if all the German people were just idiots and racist. I mean, they had other reasons to support somebody. I mean, look at the support that some modern American presidents get. They never tell you why they're really invading areas. They always give you a nice do-gooder pretext, and some people swallow it.
Well, it's interesting. Speaking of Putin's been compared with Hitler when he goes into the Crimea, but people don't know, most people don't know, when Hitler went into Czechoslovakia and went into Poland, he was going into areas that were Germany, and the majority of people living there were German speakers. Sudetenland, which had been part of Germany, and Germany was so punished at the end of World War One that people just forget, because they don't know their history, they're not taught it, that Sudetenland, where Hitler went into Czechoslovakia, was to take that land back that had been taken away from Germany after World War One. And the same thing in Poland.
They tried everything diplomatically first to get Danzig back or to make a corridor to it or something, and the Poles are not having it. But
I mean, it's not. Yeah, it's not that you. And it's, this is no apology for Hitler. But the problem is that you put everything in context, and there are no good guys in these fights. You know, I'm not a Putin fan, but I see Putin's position as being absolutely understandable, and the people of Crimea. He'll be keeping with Edward Snowden. The Nobel Prize is a joke. Of course, we have Begin has gotten it, and Obama and Kissinger.
Yeah, Henry Kissinger.
Shimon Peres. Yeah. I mean, it's Arafat, the great sellout. There are. I mean,
we should create a new prize and award it to people.
This is why you need someone like a Lewis Carroll or a Jonathan Swift to write about our times, because otherwise they're so irrational or appear to be irrational take, for example, the Israel-Palestine situation right now, these negotiations. My belief is, based on Abbas's past history of collaboration with the Israelis, and having been the person who signed over the surrender deal at Oslo in 1993, that he is following a script written by Netanyahu, in which Netanyahu is demanding that Abbas recognize Israel as a Jewish state. He doesn't want Israel to be recognized as a Jewish state. He wants Abbas not to do that. Abbas, of course, would have a problem doing that because he would lose whatever following he has, which is very little. But imagine, here's a scenario. If they break off the negotiations, Abbas, who his reputation among Palestinians in the West Bank is zero, he would now look strong having stood up to the Israelis. So his reputation would be enhanced, and he would be a leader once again. Remember, his elected office term ran out in 2008. They gave him a year extension, 2009. Technically, he legally has no position at all representing people of Palestine. But that's another fiction they could overlook. And so then you have Netanyahu looking tough to his Likud supporters. He's not going to bow to the United States, and he's not going to make a deal with the Palestinians unless they recognize Israel as a Jewish state, which was something that was suggested by Zippy Libni of the Labor Party, whatever she belongs to now. So my idea, my belief, is that negotiations will break down, and the status quo, which is what both of them want, because if there was a deal made of some sort, Abbas would not end up being the president of Palestine. He might end up being dead. Who knows? But the way it is now, if they break down these negotiations, nobody will be hurt. Nobody will be hurt. The United States is not going to punish Israel. And the Europeans, there'll be pressure, but there's counter pressure. They're not going to do it either, even though the populations of Europe are not pro-Israel, just the opposite. But they follow the lead of the United States. So I frankly think that negotiations are going exactly as the way the Israelis wanted them to go. I just yesterday I saw a communication from a former AIPAC staff member, M.J. Rosenberg. Rosenberg edited their Near East report for a number of years. He was in the AIPAC office when they started the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. And he's a foremost critic of AIPAC. Well, he remains a Zionist. He believes in a two-state solution. But he wrote a piece yesterday that yeshiva students, ultra-Orthodox, funded by Dr. Irving Moskowitz in Florida, who runs an operation called Atru Kolhenim, is in the process of buying the post office in East Jerusalem on Saladin Street, which is going to be used to house yeshiva students in East Jerusalem. Now, I don't know what Palestinians are going to sell them, but this post office is a major building, a major center of Palestinian life in East Jerusalem, and I can't believe Palestinians would let that happen without some kind of an outburst. So everything is pointing to, quote-unquote, a failure of negotiations, the failure of John Kerry, who's clueless, and that Israel is continuing to build settlements and steal more and more Palestinian land, and that will continue. And this is why...
John Kerry's full of hot air. He doesn't want to create settlements.
Oh, no, I disagree. I actually think the United States would like to make a deal and have a two-state solution, and they get their peace prizes, and then Palestine will be a protectorate of the United States and Israel, because there's no way the Palestinian state, the way they are setting it up, would be anything other than a source of cheap labor, and the idea of it being a democratic state at all is just a dream. So I have no question in my mind. The United States for a long time has wanted to have a settlement there. It makes it a lot easier for them to deal with other countries in the Middle East and their European neighbors and the Europeans who want to have a settlement as well. The U.S. gets nothing from the occupation except headaches. And I think the idea of settling that
if you assume the U.S. is out for the U.S.'s interests, but I don't think the U.S. does things that are in its own interest. Like, yes, it would be beneficial, and yes, with the way it is now, the U.S. is using or having a liability by doing Israel's bidding all the time, but that's just the thing. They're not in it for American interests. They never have.
I don't think they're trying to do Israel's bidding. The Congress is, and the U.S. Senate is, and the House of Representatives, but the humiliations that American presidents have received and officials have received at the hands of Israel has been an embarrassment for them on the world stage. The problem is they have nobody watching their back. The U.S. Congress is totally occupied by Israel, and so here's your president, Obama, and you have clueless Kerry. They would actually like, they're putting an effort into getting something that they can't achieve. And I seriously believe they want to do this despite the fact, and they don't even want to recognize the collaboration between Abbas and Netanyahu. They're putting a lot of money and effort into this, and if it fails, it doesn't make the United States look good. It doesn't make them look good. It doesn't make Kerry look good. But they don't understand, or they don't want to understand, or they can't articulate the pressures that are coming on Israel's side from the U.S. Congress. You need someone like Jonathan Swift or Lewis Carroll to write about it, because the idea that Israel and the Palestinian Authority are at odds is a joke. And yet the problem is American Palestinians won't come out and say Abbas is a traitor. The Palestinians here will not say that. They've allowed this farce to go on. And so I frankly think that it's going exactly the way Israel wants it. I think Obama and Kerry would like to resolve the situation. When Kerry makes a speech in which he says, you know, you're going to have more boycotts and sanctions, and the Israelis go crazy when he says that, he means it, except the thing is he's clueless. It's like he's like Candide in 21st century, wandering around, making all these trips and actually trying to do something that at a certain level he knows he can't do, but he can't articulate why he can't do it.
Well, I mean, I'm more cynical, but I understand your train of thought, and I can see that. I'll think about it more. But I just think it might be lip service to some of their other Arab allies to say, look, we tried to do this, but not really sincerely, and they know it's going to fail, so it doesn't matter. That's my cynical view on it, but we are out of time.
I actually think...
Sorry, yeah, we went right way over. I'll just cut it into two shows. But I always enjoy you coming on the program, and we could talk about this endlessly, I think. It's a very important issue, so I'll have you on again in the future, in the near future.
Well, very good. I enjoyed it too, Brian. Okay.
Thanks.
Good talking to you. Take care.
You too.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.